You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the January 18th, 2021 special Martin Luther King birthday edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my incredible co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Roger.
A little warm today. Still don't have any snow, but it was a pretty crowded weekend. I mean, I think I saw a lot of tourists in town.
I do believe it was busy, and it's good to hear because that's what this town needs, especially since this would have been the week we go into Sundance 2021.
Oh, wow. Yep, hard to believe Sundance 2020 is going to be virtual, and that's not for a couple of weeks. It's like at the January 28th this year, I want to say.
Yep, I believe it does start in a week. Okay. We'll see, but I will definitely bring up more info as that comes up.
Good. Well, what do we got this morning? We're going to start with Alicia Mazzara of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She's going to talk about the disproportionate way in which the COVID crisis has impacted communities of color, particularly from an economic perspective.
We'll then revisit a June 2020 interview that we did with Sven Beckert. He is a professor of history at Harvard University, and Sven spoke about the historical relationship between capitalism and slavery and its impacts on the world we live in today.
And finally, we're going to end our hour with Nicole Thomas, the owner of Latter-day Bride, and Casey Metzger, Top Shelf Utah owner, about how the current COVID relief bill, in their view, falls far short of the assistance they need and the needs of other small businesses. Lot to do today here on Mountain Money. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. This interview with Alicia Mazzara was taped last week, and we're going to play that for you now. On July 4th, 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King delivered what is labeled the American Dream speech. He said in part, "All I am saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated. We are tied in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And whatever it affects one directly, it affects all indirectly. And as long as there is extreme poverty in this world, no one can be totally rich, even if he has $1 billion. As long as diseases are rampant and millions of people cannot expect to live more than 28 or 30 years, no one can be totally healthy, even if he just got a checkup in the finest clinic of the nation. Strangely enough, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality."
As the nation continues to struggle with the coronavirus pandemic, there's no question that it's affected all of us. For some of us, it has meant that we can't see with our families, we can't go on vacation, we can't go to restaurants. But for others, the impact is far more substantial. And today seems like a particularly good day to look at the disproportionate way the virus has affected communities of color, particularly from an economic perspective. So we are fortunate today to be joined by Alicia Mazzara of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, someone who has studied how the weakening economy has affected different sectors of the American population. Welcome to Mountain Money, and thanks for joining us. Well, last week on Mountain Money, we discussed the incredible 2020 rally in the stock market. 2020 clearly demonstrated that the stock market is not the economy. Let's start by talking a little bit about how you would characterize the real economy in the country and what happened last year.
There are all different types of workers in the economy. Really only a very small portion of people own stock. And what we've really been seeing is that in a combination of, all these closures and other safety measures that have had to take place, plus, you know, the inequalities that I think were already present in the economy before the pandemic hit, have really resulted in folks in low and kind of moderate wage industries to really take the brunt of what's going on here. And, you think about what isn't closed right now, right? It's your favorite restaurant or bar. It's all of these service workers. It's your folks who take care of your kids, right? And these are industries that tend to be dominated by workers of color, particularly Black workers, particularly Black women. And as a result, we're seeing that this recession is disproportionately falling on their shoulders because of a lot of different factors that play into the fact that they tend to be more present in these industries. And we can get more into that as the program continues, but that's kind of what we're seeing.
One of the things we do want to talk about is that focus on the minority communities, and specifically how the COVID-19 recession has affected minority populations. So let's start with unemployment data, both unemployment and workforce participation data.
I think it's important to remember that even when we're not in a recession, unemployment levels are elevated for people of color, particularly Black workers, and they are lowest among white workers. So we're already looking at factors that sort of depress the employment participation and employment rate of these groups. And some of that involves unequal access to education, it involves mass incarceration, it involves hiring discrimination. And a lot of that is rooted actually in kind of the structure of our neighborhoods and where people live and all of that tying together. So going into this, we already had those disparities. And what we're just seeing is that they're just getting magnified. So stuff that we knew before, just getting more intensely magnified during the crisis.
And let's talk a little bit about what the numbers look like, at least on a relative basis. I know that, you know, starting in March, we saw a dramatic decrease in employment, and then it started to get better. Let's talk about the sort of relative impacts. How much worse has it been for the minority community with respect to employment over that time period?
Sure. So I think, you know, we just published some stuff about the latest jobs report. And when you dig into those numbers, you see it's really concentrated in, you know, service industries, in people who are childcare educators. We also see that all of these job losses were borne by women. And particularly women of color. So it's been really disproportionate along certain industries and along race and gender, no question.
And I know that you recently published some results from what is called the Pulse database. Tell us a little bit about that. Who publishes that and what does and where is it accessible?
Absolutely. So the Pulse survey is a new survey that the census started undertaking at the beginning of the pandemic to try and get some real-time information. Data comes out every week or every other week, depending on what part of the survey you're in, to really see what is going on in real time with people, including their economic status in this crisis.
And the publication that I got a chance to look at this morning is called Tracking the COVID-19 Recession's Effects on Food, Housing, and Employment Hardship, which I know is put out by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Let's talk a little bit about those three categories, because I think it's really informative to understand what's going on in an area like food, because, you know, as Americans, we're just not used to thinking of people being hungry.
Yeah, I think it is, we have great extremes in this country in terms of a great abundance of food, and yet people who every day struggle to eat enough, and a lot of kids who go hungry. The food insecurity that we have seen during this pandemic has just been, I think, just staggering. I think the latest data shows something like almost 30 million people reporting that they are not getting enough to eat. And this is, again, you can, again, same story, different verse when we talk about racial disparities here. So we see that Black adults have much higher rates of food insufficiency compared to white adults. We also see that families with kids particularly are struggling. And we also know that, you know, among, you know, demographically, who tends to be families with children in this country, it is a lot of people of color who are facing a lot of high rates of food insecurity.
The statistic that jumped out at me was the all-adult statistic of 14% households likely to experience food insufficiency. I mean, that is just an extraordinarily high number. And of course, as you just mentioned, the Black, not Latino population is at 24%. Have we ever seen numbers like that in recent history?
I don't know the long arc, but I do know that certainly what we do know from before the pandemic is this is absolutely elevated, and we've seen this trending upward over time throughout the past year.
Can you give us a perspective of where that number was before COVID?
We don't have the Pulse survey data from before COVID, but we have other survey data on food insecurity. And over the course of the full 12 months of 2019, that rate was only 3% compared to this 14%. So that is like basically a fivefold difference.
I don't even know what to say to that. That's huge. And I know as well that I'm seeing a lot, whether it be on television or I'm reading, that you know, people are putting together food banks. They're trying to help kind of bridge the gap, but that's not going to come even close, is it?
Right. There's just a limit to, I think, what we can do through food banks and donations, who are very overwhelmed right now. We really need large scale government action to address problems of this magnitude.
Let's turn to housing, which I know is a favorite topic of yours. We certainly have seen a lot of rent delinquencies and people falling behind on their mortgage. Can we talk about the scope of that a little bit? How big a problem is that?
Yes. So we are seeing a lot of folks reporting that they are behind on rent. About one in five renter adults are saying that they are in a household that is behind on rent. Again, there are big disparities by race, with Black renters reporting almost, I think it's 28%, facing rent hardship. And so it's people who, you know, they've lost their jobs. There's no relief. So I think with housing, it's really important to step back and look at where things were before the recession, before the pandemic. So we were already in a housing crisis. We do not have enough rental assistance for folks. It is not like food assistance, where anyone who can qualify can get it. And so what that means is that even before this, some 23 million low-income renters were paying over half their income for rent, which is really unsustainable, right? Any little emergency, you could potentially be missing your rent, facing eviction. So you have this coming into this crisis, and then we're just seeing this put just extreme pressure on folks. And even though we've had a number of eviction moratoriums, it's been spotty, and there are people who are either being evicted or becoming homeless during this health crisis, where it's really important, right, to be able to have access to like your own space and, you know, clean bathroom and all of that. And then on top of that, you have people who maybe they're still in their apartments, but they are accumulating thousands of dollars in back rent. And so that is causing a lot of stress for people.
So knowing that, again, people have, you know, past due rent, when the pandemic's over and everyone is hopefully able to get back to work, they're still going to be in debt.
That's right. And that's why it's really important, we think, to get robust rental assistance expanded and relief for folks, because what we don't want to see is, you know, an eviction moratorium ends and then people get immediately evicted because they have months of back rent that they've had no way to pay prior to that.
So last spring, Congress passed a pretty substantial COVID relief bill, which was recently augmented with an additional cash payment. What's your perspective on whether or not we've had sufficient government intervention to this point, particularly in view of the proposal that President-elect Biden rolled out last Thursday? Do you have any, what's your perspective on that?
We have been seeing food, rent, and just economic hardship tick up over months and months, and we have seen very little government action, which has been deeply troubling. We know from the last recession that it's really important to get in there and provide economic stimulus to not only boost the economy, but just, you know, deal with the human cost of this type of health and economic crisis. So while the CARES Act had some really important provisions in it, including expanding unemployment benefits, the $1,200 stimulus payment, it hasn't been enough. And when we saw, when a lot of that stuff started expiring in the summer, that people started really suffering again. And so we are really heartened by the latest Biden-Harris package that has come out. It really does provide robust relief along a lot of really important lines, including unemployment, housing assistance, food assistance, that could really make a difference. And another key thing about it, and I think a key thing about just combating anything that's going on in the economy, is we need provisions that actually end when the economy is showing that we are in a good place versus at an arbitrary time.
So one of the goal of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is really to pursue federal and state policies and make sure they're designed to reduce poverty and inequality and restore fiscal responsibility in equitable and effective ways. So you were already on this path to be able to start to address these items. But now with COVID and the kind of rampant increase of unemployment and housing issues and food issues, How is your organization kind of taking a new look at what you do, or how are you helping make sure that this new legislation is containing what we need in the right way?
That's a good question. So you are right that we're on a path to creating more economic and racial equity, and this has set us back. But I think we can be intentional in the way that we design things. I think we can be intentional about the way that we think about how history has played into public policy, and therefore how do we need to design policy to address those things. But I think what the center has absolutely been doing over the last 4 years is thinking a lot harder about, we need to look at data that is cut by race, ethnicity, and gender, and think really hard about, okay, you know, not making policy informed by that is going to simply perpetuate what we are already experiencing. And so being really intentional, I think, about that and bringing that equity lens to our work and to policy, it's been a really wonderful shift. I think there are absolutely policies that, you know, do lift all boats, but we also need more targeted relief for the people who need it the most, particularly in a world of scarce resources.
It seems like at times that when we have regulations and policies that benefit, you know, a certain type of population or a certain group, especially when we talk about racial minorities, it feels like, again, like those are the hardest to get past. You know, those are the hardest for everyone to understand, or at least those who are making the decisions to understand. And it feels like those types of regulations are a bigger hurdle. And knowing that we're going to have to go through that, and we're going to have open discussion so that everyone understands why this is important. I mean, can we really get there?
It's a question I ask myself often, to be honest with you, right? So the things, right, that are easiest politically to pass are things that have broad support, right? So like everybody gets Social Security. People love Social Security. Whereas I think if you start to do sometimes targeted programs, people start saying, well, what about me? And also there's a smaller base of people who are supporting that who can be a stronger political voice. But I think about that quote you read at the beginning about how our fates are tied together and we don't succeed if we don't succeed collectively, as opposed to saying, well, I've got mine and forget the rest of you. So I think a lot of times some of our work is making the case that a policy that is beneficial for, say, Black people or immigrants or you know, women, actually is beneficial to everybody. Everybody benefits from this. And I think another thing to go back to why we're here today is to think about, you know, the legacy of civil rights and our history and all of the things that that has brought everybody. And that in order to really honor the work, we also need to look at our history and think about, you know, how does public policy play into that? And then I sometimes think that people's understanding of history is missing a few pieces to really contextualize the policy. But we seem to be starting to have a bit of a reckoning, which gives me some hope.
The idea that collective good is a fundamental element of American society is really an appropriate way for us to end our conversation. And we have been talking to Alicia Mazzara of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks so much for joining us on this Martin Luther King holiday.
Thank you for having me.
Stevie Wonder released Happy Birthday as part of his Hotter Than July album in 1981. While the song is certainly well known, what is not as well known is its relationship to the creation of the MLK holiday. Wonder performed the song at a major rally in January of 1981 when more than 25,000 people appeared on the National Mall in the quest for MLK Day. Wonder said that day, quote, "We ought to have a way to honor this human being and reaffirm the ideals he lived and died for. Designating his birthday a national holiday would create an event for all Americans, for Dr. King was a champion for justice and liberty." Right after that, he performed Happy Birthday live, probably for about the first time. 2 years later, the Martin Luther King holiday was added to the list of national holidays. Who we got next, Allison?
Up next, we've got Sven Beckert. He is the professor of history at Harvard University, and he spoke with us about the relationship between capitalism and slavery and its impacts on the world we live in today. This interview was recorded in June. To understand the significance of the institution of slavery on the history of the United States, it is useful to probe the relationship of slave labor to the development of the U.S. economy, not only in the South, but in the nation as a whole. And the key to understanding the economic forces that drove the growth of slavery in this country is cotton.
In 1790, the U.S. produced some 1.5 million pounds of cotton. By 1830, 1 million Americans, mostly slaves, grew cotton. And by 1860, that number was some 2 billion pounds of cotton. It was by far the nation's largest export in the first half of the 19th century, as the U.S. became the key cotton supplier to the mills of England and the mills of New England, which in turn exported cloth around the world. And while human slavery was abolished in the British Empire in 1807, its continued existence and growth in the U.S. was a critical factor in the growth of the U.S. economy. So why was the U.S. such a fertile ground for the growth of the cotton industry? What were the political, agricultural, and economic forces that drove that growth? And while the significance of cotton to the Southern economy is widely known, what was the role of Northern economic and industrial interests in the slave-dependent cotton industry? And what happened after the Civil War when slavery was abolished? We're fortunate today to be joined by Professor Sven Beckert of Harvard. His book, Empire of Cotton, takes a sweeping look at the history of cotton and its role in the development of modern capitalism. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money, Professor Beckert.
Good morning, Roger. Great to talk to you.
So let's start again with big picture. Why was cotton such an important product in the 18th century? What was driving world demand?
So basically, cotton was an important product already in the 18th century because as industrialization began to unfold on the European continent, that industrialization focused on the production of cotton textiles. Cotton textiles had been produced for centuries in places such as South Asia, in Central America, in Central and Western Africa, but there was increasing demand for cotton textiles in Europe. And in the middle of the 18th century, European engineers developed new techniques of how to produce cotton more efficiently. And thus, the demand for raw cotton increased tremendously in the last decades of the 18th century. And as I'm sure we will discuss, much of that cotton eventually would come from the United States.
So I do want to get to that. So I think what was happening, and I did spend some time with the book over the weekend, which is delightful, by the way, really interesting, was that all of a sudden there was this new relatively inexpensive clothing made out of cotton that was being sold around the world. So the right. demand starts to go up. And what had previously been coming largely from, I take it, India and to some extent China, was now going to be grown in the United States. What were the factors that led to that rapid growth of cotton in the U.S.?
Right. So when the European cotton textile industry began to expand in the last decades of the 18th century, that industry needed certainly much more cotton. And as you mentioned, traditionally that cotton had come from places such as the Ottoman Empire of what is today Turkey, and it had come partly from Western Africa, and it had also come from what today is India. And it had been produced by peasants to produce cotton along with their rice or corn and other such things. But when the demand for that cotton shot up, that supply was not sufficient anymore. Prices of that cotton produced by peasants increased on the European continent. And thus, European manufacturers searched for new sources of cotton. And where they looked first was in Brazil and in the West Indies, in the Caribbean, which were parts of the world that had already produced agricultural commodities in very great quantities at cheap prices for European markets for a couple of centuries by drawing on slave labor, especially the production of sugar. And In the late 18th century, they began to look at the United States as a potential source for raw cotton, and they were able to do so because the United States was ecologically very well suited for the production of cotton. Thanks to Eli Whitney's cotton gin, which was invented in 1793, it was suddenly much easier to separate the seed from the fiber for the particular cotton that was grown in the United States. And then decisively, In the United States, there were a lot of enslaved workers who could be forced to dedicate their efforts to cotton agriculture. And this is then exactly what happened. So it's a combination of ecological factors, technical factors, and social factors, especially the availability of inexpensive labor.
Looking at that development and how things come to be, when I think of cotton, I think of plantations. And
yeah.
Did the growth of cotton immediately go to plantations, or was it more of a small farmer's crop that they would rotate with other types of crops? Who came in to purchase like large swaths of land to understand that cotton is the single industry it wanted to go for?
Right. That's an excellent question. And historically, it is true that the most cotton, much of the world, was grown by small farmers, by peasants, and it was grown alongside other crops, as I had mentioned before. But in the United States, pretty much from the beginning, once cotton began to be exported from the United States to Europe, which was in the 1790s, much of that cotton would be grown on relatively large plantations that engaged in the monocultural production of cotton. So they didn't mix various crops with one another, but they focused their efforts on the production of cotton and on the production of cotton that was to be exported into world markets, and they were able to do so because they had potentially huge amounts of land available, which was largely taken from the native inhabitants of these territories. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, they also were able to recruit very rapidly very large numbers of workers to grow that cotton. So this was kind of the competitive advantage of the United States compared to other regions of the world, was on the one hand the availability of all of that land, which could be dispossessed from its native inhabitants, and then the dispossession of the labor from enslaved African Americans.
We all think of slavery as a Southern economic phenomenon, but let's talk a little bit about the relationship between the Southern states and the use of enslaved labor and Northern industrialism.
By looking at cotton, you can see how deeply this was really a national industry. I mean, it's true that the cotton was exclusively grown in the American South, but there were a lot of Northerners and Northern businesses and Northern institutions that were deeply implicated in this cotton economy as well. And indeed, as many abolitionists in the 19th century, but also many Southerners in the 19th century remarked upon, the Southern plantation economy, the Southern cotton-growing economy, was entirely dependent on its relationship to cities such as Boston, New York, Philadelphia. And it was because the cotton economy in the South needed to draw on trade networks, the things that they grew, the cotton, needed to be transported into world markets, and it was largely Northern merchants who were organizing that particular trade. And the Southern plantation economy, as it expanded so rapidly, was also dependent on capital, and much of that capital came from Europe, but it was transferred into the South through especially New York City and Baltimore, banks and merchant houses. And then, of course, the transport of this cotton also drew on shipping capacities, on sea insurance, on other such things. Much of that also came from the northern states. So the way how the Southern cotton economy was connected to the global market was largely via people and institutions that were located not directly in the South, but were located in the North or also in Europe. And then last but not least, of course, it's not just Great Britain and it's not just the European continent that experienced the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century, but by the 19th century, by the early decades of the 19th century, the United States begins to experience an Industrial Revolution. It does industrialize, and it does industrialize mostly in places like the mid-Atlantic states, in New England, And what industry is at the forefront of the American Industrial Revolution? It's the cotton industry, and thus the American Industrial Revolution itself relies very much on the raw materials produced by enslaved workers in the American South.
So I understand that the word sustainably sourced was not used during these times, but if people were to look at that, or if you were to look at the northern states, did they understand the connection that they had to slavery? And when the Civil War broke out, like, did those people in the North who had the connection to the textile industry, were they kind of, you know, one foot in, one foot out? It could be bad for us with regards to the economy, but it is something that, you know, we believe is wrong to enslave humans.
Yes, that's an excellent observation. And so the short answer is yes, people were contemporaries in the 19th century, were very much aware of this particular connection. And indeed, when the Southerners seceded in 1861, they believed they would succeed in that. They would be able to remain independent from the United States, because they believed that the United States was just so dependent on the raw material that they produced that the United States could not possibly afford to fight a war against the South. And if you look at 19th century abolitionists, they remarked over and over again on the great great dependence of many northern industries, of many northerners, on the cotton slave economy of the American South. So there was a great, I think this was, you know, almost, this was, the people did understand that quite well in the 19th century, that there was this deep connection. But in some ways, after the Civil War, once we looked back at this history, we convinced ourselves that they're really two separate histories. There's the history of slavery that is limited largely to the American South on the one hand, and then there's the history of freedom and the overcoming of slavery that is a history of New England and the Mid-Atlantic region and the American West. And because we were so invested in that notion that there is this fundamental difference, which of course is not completely wrong, but there is, you know, as I explained earlier, there is also a problem with that, because we convinced ourselves of this particular way of looking at this history that we forgot that there was actually a long time awareness of this particular connection between slavery and the nation as a whole. And so I think what we need to remember in this conversation is that the United States, that when we think about slavery, we need to think about it as a national institution, and we need to think about it as a national history. And thus, when we are dealing with the after effects of slavery, which are still with us today, we need to think of that also not just as a regional problem, but we need to think of it very much also as a national problem.
Professor Beckert, thanks for joining us today. We've been talking to Professor Sven Beckert about the sort of relationship between cotton slavery and the development of the U.S. economy. His book, Empire of Cotton, is a wonderful study. It is available in the Park City Library, or at least it will be when I take it back. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Allison, we'll have Nicole Thomas and Casey Metzger in a minute, but I wanted to stop, and as we've been discussing our programming for the next, you know, few months here on Mountain Money, and one of the things I wanted to remind our viewers, listeners, is that we at Mountain Money are really interested in finding a diversity of interesting guests. If you have someone you think would be good for us to talk to, please let us know at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Absolutely, and in helping fill that calendar from listeners and what they want to hear really just makes sure that we're in tune and have the pulse on what our listeners are interested in listening to. And we do everything from books discussions to really experts in certain areas and different types of products that people use for business, money, and finance.
And particularly if you found a new local business that you think our listeners should hear about, please let us know. Okay. Allison, what do we know about whether we're ever going to get any snow? I mean, I think the weather this morning said we might get some at the end of the week, but you know, here on Sweet Alley, as I'm looking at the mountain, watching a few skiers come down quitting time, it looks pretty grim in terms of snow cover.
Absolutely. I think one thing that I've been talking with people about, at least we're getting a bit of temperatures where they can continue to make snow. Like you saw them up at Park City Mountain Resort making snow on CBs last week. So hoping that we can kind of keep that base with what we can with those lower temperatures. However, there is no snow in the forecast. So I think for us, we got to just cross our fingers and hope it all comes together. So right now, we're going to be inviting in Nicole Thomas as well as Casey Metzger. On January 13th, 2021, there were 56 small business owners from across Utah. They joined 2,000 of their peers from all 50 states in the District of Columbia in calling on Congress to pass additional federal pandemic relief to keep America's main streets healthy. Goldman Sachs' 10,000 Small Businesses Voices launched the Virtual Hill Day to provide a platform to advocate for policy changes that will help keep their businesses, employees, and communities vibrant by offering them the tools, resources, and training needed to make their voices heard. This morning we are joined by Nicole Thomas, owner of Latter Day Bride, and Casey Metzger, owner of Top Shelf Utah. They are two of the 10,000 Small Business Voices that are speaking today. Casey and Nicole, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
So I think maybe just to kick it off, I know that both of you were involved in the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program and you're graduates of that. Can you just give the listeners a reminder of what that program is and how it benefited your business?
Certainly. I'm the CEO and founder of Latter Day Bride, and we've been in business for 20 years, and I did the program this last fall of 2019. And even though I'd been in business for 20 years, it was just instrumental in some of the tool sets that it gave me. We all kind of have our strengths in our area of business and our weaknesses. And so some of the areas that were not maybe my strong suit, it gave me a lot of tools that helped sharpen that skill set and therefore a lot more confidence. One of the valuable things that you do in the program is you put together a growth plan and you vet that through the whole core cohort. And so I started implementing my growth plan in December, and just the discipline and focus of having to kind of set aside time in your busy schedule to focus on growing your business was just a huge blessing. And then when COVID hit, the support network of the Goldman Sachs in terms of understanding all the funding that was available out there, representing Small Business Voices, has just been instrumental for me.
Casey, did you have any observations on your participation in the program?
Sure. I would just echo Nicole's remarks and the fact that, you know, I was an alumni. I'm an alumni from 2013, so that was cohort four. And since then, I've experienced more than 4x growth, created a lot of jobs, and, you know, really honed in on what I didn't know as a business owner and was able to capitalize on that. We all have great business ideas, and we're sometimes technicians or managers of good businesses, but to be an owner of a business and to leverage the skill sets that they teach you, it's quite a remarkable thing. They say it's an MBA in, on steroids and really fast, you know, and so the scholarships that they give out really do not only help business owners, but also help a lot of people create paths and careers that help in that effort.
We want to segue on to a little bit about the impact of COVID on the various businesses. But, you know, Allison mentioned in the intro that the Goldman Sachs program was involved in calling for changes in congressional legislation. Were either of you involved in that effort at all?
We both were.
Good. Tell us a little bit about whether the proposed legislation that has now been announced by President-elect Biden meets any of the requests that you had in your legislative proposal.
Nicole, you want to take that one?
Unless you don't know. That's
yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Nicole.
Sorry with the delay.
Early.
Yeah. In terms of some of the things that we asked for, I've got to be honest with that. We were just on a phone call on Wednesday for Capitol Hill Day, and we laid out all of the things that we were interested in. And as far as I know, I think it meets most of those, but I haven't gotten my head into all the nitty-gritty details of it. So I feel like I'm not completely informed to comment on that.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the things that you were interested in. What measures were you looking for, regardless of whether it was picked up in the proposed legislation?
Go ahead,
Casey.
I would say, like Nicole said, I think it was the event that we had with the legislators. It's a little bit early to tell. There's a big agenda that Goldman Sachs is pushing. And some of the things that, you know, that they're pushing are lowering health care costs for small businesses. Those seem to be, they're really high. And, you know, protecting small businesses from potential COVID relief litigation, that's a big deal. Increasing access to affordable health care, incentivizing large businesses to use more small business as vendors. So big businesses using small businesses would help. And there's a number of others. And, you know, it's about, you know, a lot of small businesses such as ours have been scaled down like big time. And to build up to get back to your revenues that you were used to, it's going to take a lot. And some of the incentive would be some long-term and creative financial access to capital. Because essentially small businesses, if you're taking a hard hit, 70 to 80%, where's the incentive for us as small businesses to stay in it and to rebound? And because we're now 10, 12, 15 years back, right? And so having some access to capital that, you know, might have favorable terms and things such as the initiatives that I said on the agenda would really help us, you know, get back at it and do what we're trying to do and to contribute to the economies and create jobs and create opportunities. And it's, you know, there's a long way to go. And so this, as great as these PPP loans are, they've really kept a lot of us in the game. But it's a lot longer of a outlook for us to say, all right, how do we really rebound over the next few years? Because some of us are down to, you know, very few people where we used to have 50, 60 people on staff.
I know that.
And I think just even to expand on what Casey said, it was a great opportunity for Goldman to create a platform that they could hear the voice of some of our struggles. And I think that was one of the big, takeaways from that is when we were doing these meetings and meeting with our fellow business owners, some of them, you know, we small businesses employ, you know, almost 50% of the workforce. And a lot of us have taken pay cuts. We've dipped into our savings to keep these businesses going because we understand that if our business isn't around, you know, there goes anywhere from 5 to 50 to 100 jobs. And so part of what we were trying to convey is there's a big emotional toll that business owners are bearing in terms of trying to get creative in ways that they can stay alive because we understand how instrumental small business is to community and job creation.
The information that I was able to receive with regards to this topic gave some stats, and it was part of a survey that was conducted last month. And it stated that 42% of businesses laid off employees or cut compensation. More than half had to stop paying themselves, and a third dipped into personal savings to keep their businesses operational. And of course, the news is bleaker for Black small business owners. 61% have forgone paying themselves, and 58% report using personal savings to stay open. So knowing that you guys started kind of highlighting, you know, what this is, I mean, you guys are, I guess, being pulled between, you know, wanting to be able to stay open, wanting to keep people employed, and then also just your personal finances. How are both of you doing with your businesses?
Yeah. So I think Casey and I are both in the event industry, and we've got a little different role that we play, whereas I'm a little bit pre-event and he's more, you know, at the actual event. And I think for me, it's just been, we've had to get creative. We've reduced our hours so that we're more efficient, so that the staff that we have, we can have some time behind, you know, since we're not getting the traffic that we typically do during those hours that we're closed, we can really push initiatives and work on some growth strategies, have time to figure out ways to pivot. We launched a Try It Before You Buy It program where brides could go online on our website and pay a nominal fee and choose three of their favorite dresses and have them shipped to the comfort of their own home to be able to try them on. And to be able to do that, we had to get really, you know, strategic with what, where we spent our inventory dollars. We noticed that, you know, people were having even shorter timelines for engagement. So to be able to support this Try Before You Buy, we wanted to put our dollars into dresses that didn't need as many alterations and to have a fair amount of stock on hand so that, you know, we could actually ship these dresses out to customers to try online. So it's just, we've had to be creative. We've had to, you know, take some pay cuts, reduce our hours, and just look at creative ways that we can kind of operate on a skeletal cost structure to, you know, every month counts, and every month that we can stay in business is a month that we're closer to hopefully finding a solution and returning to a new normal.
Before we get to the reception and talk to Casey, I wanted to ask another question about the way in which the community has reacted to COVID with respect to holding of weddings. Are people still holding weddings? Are they holding smaller weddings? But, you know, just talk to us a little bit about how your customers have reacted to the pandemic.
Yeah, do you want to take that one, Casey?
No, Casey's going to be the reception. I wanted to finish with, go ahead, Casey.
Oh, you want to hear my viewpoint on that?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we were trying to get across to Congress, too, that us as business owners are trying to figure out. We definitely have had brides still getting married. I'm in a little bit of a, more of a niche market, and we're still seeing weddings happen, but we are seeing shorter timelines. We've had brides get really creative. I know one did a drive-by wedding in a park early on. I think it was about a month into COVID. So we're still seeing that. One of the kind of unknowns for us is in other times, like in 2008, where we had the recession, once we weathered that, we saw a big boom. But I think the question that we're struggling with is how many brides still got married, did maybe more of an informal ceremony, how many just, you know, went and tied the knot with intentions of throwing a big celebration later as to maybe change their mind the farther that we get into it. So we've definitely seen brides getting married, not at the numbers. And the big unknown for us is when things do start to normalize, did we lose customers in the process, or how much of a boon will we have when it comes back?
And Casey, I know I cut you off, so talk to us a little bit about how your customers have reacted to the pandemic.
So there aren't very many customers. Unfortunately, I'm in the business of celebrating large, you know, celebrating life's occasions in large format, right? From weddings to corporate groups to festivals and everything in between. And so I think at right now it's, you know, just trying to track down that light at the end of the tunnel, right? And in the meantime, how do you stay relevant? Because I'm predicting the roaring 2020s when it does turn around. You know, I don't know when that will be. We all have our fictitious date or saying, hey, by June or July or August, this is when it's going to scale up. But there's a lot of pent-up demand. We know it's coming. And that's going to pose its own challenges for small businesses, no matter what sector you're in. And so in the meantime, while we wait and to determine when that really is, we've got to make a lot of assumptions and forecasts. And we've done a pivot project called the Bartender's Box. If we're not going to be able to entertain guests in groups of 200, 300 people or whatnot, we created a bartender's box, which is in, you know, celebrates what we, or it contributes to what we do normally, but it's a fun, fresh, and easy cocktail experience delivered to your door. It's literally learning a brand new business, you know, marketing to the consumer, and it's retail and e-commerce. But at the end of the day, it's been a great opportunity for us to work with the skeletal crew that I have that's amazing and learn together to create a business just to provide some cash flow. Is it going to save us if we didn't have any assistance? Probably not. Who knows? We might get lucky. But it's really given us the ability to stay positive, to flex our creative muscles, and do what we like to do and just do it in a different format. But with that comes a lot of learning and a few expensive mistakes along the way. So that's how we're dealing with it. And to answer, that's a long-winded question answer, but one thing I have to say is community definitely helps. You know, when we had the bar boxes going out for the holiday, it was amazing to see the names of people that were supporting it, whether they were customers of ours or neighbors. And that's what it's all about. Community wants to see the businesses that they support normally survive. And that was a very flattering thing to see all the people that were supporting it. You're like, oh, I know them. I don't care if this is a pity project. I'm in until I get to the other side.
So we've got time for just one more question. And for me, that question is, you know, as you're talking, Casey, how we know how to support small businesses right now is to patronize them. But with regards to the legislative efforts and what you need from Congress, are there ways for our listeners to be able to help in that area too?
I think so. I think it would go a long way for people to write our state senators and representatives and let them know how important the, you know, fabric of small business is in their community. You take Park City, for example, and it's been going through a lot of changes the past few years, and you've seen a lot of small businesses not be able to stay there on Main Street. And it's the difference of, you know, being able to travel and go to cities and have the unique thread of businesses that make up that city and that
Nicole,
culture.
Nicole, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're running out of time. So I apologize, but you've been listening to Mountain Money, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.